Hello everyone and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host Matt and welcome to the show. First big announcement, Appalachia, our mini documentary on the flora of these wonderful mountains has been released. You can watch the full length 20 minute documentary over at youtube.com/indefenseofplants. Go check it out, let us know what you're thinking, and then click subscribe if you enjoyed it. We've got plenty more videos on the way, but this one is super exciting because A, it's the first one we've done outside of the state of Illinois, and B, it's a longer length one, and I get to showcase some of my favorite species that I encounter in my workings and doings in southern Appalachia. But you're here for the podcast, so what do I have for you today? I'm very excited for my guest because he's not only someone that I've known about for a bit, but his work is just this perfect mix of two of my great interests, which is paleontology and botany. And actually, you could throw a third one in there, even conservation. Joining us today is Jeff Banca. He is a graduate student at the University of California at Berkeley. And Jeff's work is super interesting because he's using living plant species to test hypothesized drivers of mass extinctions through time. Now, if you listen to Jeff kind of explain how he approaches this work, it actually makes a lot more sense. And I'm super excited to bring our conversation today because most of his work focuses in on the lycophytes and their various relatives. So he focuses mostly on club mosses, quill warts, and spike mosses. But Jeff has this incredible window back into a time that is very ancient. I mean, we're talking early days of plants colonizing the terrestrial habitats on this planet, and he's using extant species, so ones that you can grow in your own garden, to study how these plants would have grown and interacted with the world around them. It's incredible work, and I'm super excited for our conversation because it just kind of evolved as we went in. I didn't really have any expectations in terms of the way I wanted the conversation to go, but Jeff's interests are so just well thought out and well articulated that this is going to be a fun conversation for you either way. No matter which angle you approach this topic, Jeff's got something to talk about. All right, before we get there, though, I've got a few orders of business to take care of first. If you're enjoying this podcast and you'd like to support it, please head on over to patreon.com/indefenseofplants and see what we got going on over there. For a little bit of money each month, you can get yourself kickbacks like stickers, access to the VIP section of the indefenseofplants.com website, and for those of you looking to get just a little bit more in return, you can even get a producer credit on this show. For instance, today's episode is produced in part by Alan, Sebastian, Erne, Holly, Clifton, Katharina, Shane, Amy, Caitlin, Rosanna, Mary Jane, Manuel, Jennifer, Sarah, Sienna and Garth, Troy, Margie, Laura, and Mark. Wow. That list is growing, and I really appreciate it. It is making this podcast so much easier to do, and you have all of yourselves to thank for that. Podcasting can get a little pricey from month to month because you have to have a website, you have to host the audio files, and you just have to get to and from different interviews and pick up various items of equipment that make podcasting possible. So thank you for everyone who has supported it thus far. If money over a series of donations isn't your thing, you can head on over to indefenseofplants.com, scroll down on the right-hand side of the blog page, and click on that donate button where you can make a one-time lump sum donation of any amount, and trust me, it helps. If money isn't your thing at all, which I completely understand, at the very least consider subscribing to and reviewing this podcast on whatever podcatcher you use to download it. Been getting a lot of good reviews lately, and one of them really stood out the other day, so I'd actually like to read that one to you if you don't mind. Alright, so this one comes to us from someone named Hot Chalk, which I'm assuming stands for hot chocolate, and since it's starting to get cooler out, good name choice. Hot Chalk says, "Great! Love listening to this while I work. Love learning about plants. Love the passion in this from Matt and all people interviewed. Just lovely. If you love plants or want to love them, pick this one up." Thanks, Hot Chalk. I really appreciate that. So, yes, the thing about reviews is it not only helps me make a better podcast for you, the listener, but it also helps In Defense of Plants reach a wider audience. And the whole goal here at In Defense of Plants is to help cure plant blindness one week at a time. And when you review or let people know or let the world know what you think of this podcast, it helps the podcatchers recommend this podcast to people that haven't heard about it yet. So when you look down at your recommended show notes or whatever you're listening to it on, that's how they make those recommendations. So if you would like to help spread the word that botany is amazing and plants are incredible organisms worth appreciating in their own right, then make sure to hit review and then hit subscribe. All right, entirely enough out of me. let's head on over to my conversation with Jeff. I know you're going to enjoy this one. All right, well, hey, Jeff Banka, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about you tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me. I'm Jeff Banka, and I'm a graduate student here at University of California, Berkeley, and I study paleobotany, so the study of ancient plants.
Awesome. That already sounds cool. You know, was it always plants? Was it always paleobotany? Where did you kind of get going with your career path here?
I think with my sort of love affair with plants started in high school, and I originally was really into animals mostly. I originally wanted to work with crocodiles back in high school. So I actually sort of oddly went backdoor trying to go through a aquatic sciences background to go do field research on crocodilians early on, and then realized that, oh, this is an extremely dangerous line of work and really hard. And I mean, I liked fossils and prehistoric stuff my whole life. I never really grew up, so that was sort of the closest I get to a dinosaur.
Right on.
And but when I was in high school, sort of dabbling with all sorts of exotic animals, I mean, I used to keep pythons and boas and all sorts of things and breed reptiles at home, but it was very expensive, very costly, and everything that I had could bite. And, you know, wasn't really happy to be in a cage, so it was a little sad for me. So I saw my first Venus flytrap. I don't remember when exactly, but yeah, that was sort of the tipping point for me going, oh, well, plants are not greenery. There's a lot going on with them. So I started getting into the carnivorous plant bug. I mean, that was a sort of my gateway drug, like many botanists, I'm sure. And I started raising Nepenthes and just fell in love with these plants and sort of was thinking, oh, well, I also did a lot of art, so I wanted to do these sorts of displays of, you know, what would these carnivorous plants look like in their environment if I were to, you know, do a big terrarium to show guests and such. So I started looking at photographs of habitats and saw these, I guess for lack of a better way to describe it, these, you know, apple green pipe cleaners on acid, just kind of scrambling around these Nepenthes. It's going, what on earth are those plants? And I realized they were lycophytes later on. And I was like, whoa, I've got to grow me some of those. So little did I know that was going to become sort of a motivating factor for much of my career. It just started out with, oh, well, you know, I started contacting people who I thought might have some and found out that literally nobody was growing these things. And it was a huge lineage of plants that was, you know, extremely primeval, you know, it diverged over 400 million years ago. And the more I started learning about them and particularly how much was not known about them, just the deeper and deeper my interest got in them. So paleobotany was certainly an interest of mine. But, you know, as you're saying, you can be really interested in it, but if there's no opportunity to sort of, you know, find an in or an outlet for it, it sort of just stays there and it's hard to pursue. But when I was in undergrad, I was taking a botany class while I was still in fisheries, and my teacher pulled me aside and he goes, well, you know, we just got a paleobotanist on staff, by the way, and she's just starting her lab up. You should probably go talk to her. And so I was like, oh my God, people can get paid to do this? What? So I like talked to her and she's like, well, we have this new early land plant assemblage up there, up in Washington. I was up at the University of Washington at this time. And she goes, yeah, well, nobody's working on these ancient plant fossils up there. You want to go up and take a look at them? I was like, absolutely. So my then advisor, Dr. Caroline Stromberg up at the University of Washington, sort of helped me enter that world and start learning what it's like to work with fossil plants and, you know, everything from, you know, the wonder to the frustrations of how to identify these things from these tiny little bits of plant bits and rocks that have been crushed and you know, cooked for, you know, hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be a little bit of a challenge. but that's cool. I didn't realize you worked with Dr. Stromberg. She's been on the podcast before.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty new to the podcast here. I'd heard Chad Hespe's podcast recently. It was just got hooked.
Nice.
So
yeah, that was a good one. In his voice is he's very soothing.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. he's a great guy to talk to. Like, yeah. Just go, oh my God, please talk to me about plants. This is wonderful.
Now, see, you brought up so many cool things, and you've had such an interesting trajectory that you kind of segued you in, and I'm, you know, we can kind of go in a little bit more deeper about, you know, that jump full on into paleobotany, but kind of want to back up for a second because, you know, this was born out of an interest of growing plants, which I think a lot of people listening can empathize, you know, whether you're actually studying things, you know, directly, or just a lot of it's born out of just loving to grow plants at some point. And, you know, it's strange because even now you do see lycopods in the hobby from time to time, but they're definitely not a common thing. You know, what was your experience like trying to grow these when there was literally no information around or hardly any?
Yeah, it was disheartening for a long time. I probably spent close to about 7 or 8 years trying to figure them out. I mean, probably in the first 2-3 years of trying to grow them was rough because there just was nothing out. Well, there was hardly anything out there, but the information that was out there was, well, it was in good conscience, but not really, it didn't work. So I basically was recommended to grow these plants in, you know, dark shaded environments. You know, think of ferns. I mean, they're spore bearing plants. And, you know, grow them like a woodland fern in these, you know, rich acid sort of soils. And so I tried doing all these things that were recommended and just kept killing these plants. But the trouble with the lycophytes is that they're very slow growing. So, You could think you're doing really well with them for a year or two, and then they suddenly just rot on you.
Ooh.
And you realize, oh, well, the thing never rooted whatsoever. It was just kind of hanging on for dear life for that long and looked just fine. So in that way, they're probably good in the florist trade. You know?
Yeah.
But it was really difficult. That was a challenge because it was hard to gauge, you know, whether they were actually happy. And then I got to a point of frustration where I decided to sentence a few of my plants to death because I just was giving up. I was going, oh, I can't do this anymore. I can't keep, you know, hiking up and climbing these mountains, going after these highland lycophytes up in the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, it takes a lot of effort to find these things sometimes. And I just stuck it into a batch of clay and put it on a greenhouse bench in full sunlight and was like, okay, at least this will probably kill you faster. Just wiped my hands of it and left. I was working at the University of Washington Botany Greenhouse at that time.
Okay.
And under our greenhouse manager at the time, Doug Ewing, he had given me all this space to sort of play with these ancient plants under the sort of agreement that I'll help you build up our evolutionary teaching collection if I can figure out how to grow these things. So I had all this space to play with, and the manager Doug came up to me, I don't know, maybe a few months later, and he goes, you need to clean off this bench over here. It's accumulated, you know, a lot of trash and a lot of growth supplies. So I went in there and I just started cleaning this up, and I came across this big flat that was covered in moss, but I noticed these weird little hot green, you know, spikes coming up out of the moss. And I was like, oh, I think I know what that is. I started peeling back the moss, and lo and behold, this club moss, this Lycopodium clavatum, had just exploded in this pot. It was just sent out these hydra-like runners all over the place there, and was just had these almost like photosynthetic snorkels poking up through the moss. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's exactly what it wanted. It wanted full sunlight. It wanted just the nastiest soil I could stick it in. Wow. And it just wanted to be left alone for a while.
So this was the plant that you had put out there and sentenced to death.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah.
Unknowingly, I was like, oh, well, wait, they want everything opposite of everything that I've been taught. So yeah, after I had that sort of success, I was going, well, I wonder if these other lycophytes also like, you know, these sort of substrates. And so I started getting a hold of everything I could. I was contacting herbariums all over, you know, North America, and I was getting things sent in from, all over, exotic and native lycophytes. And I just started using this medium I was developing. And lo and behold, every lineage I stuck into the soil recipe just took off. Wow. And I was going, oh man, well, I guess this works. So yeah, I was sort of beyond belief. I was going, man, this is just not where I would have gone with this. But after these years, you know, about maybe 5 years of sort of playing with it and seeing all these different genera of these lycophytes doing so well in it, I was trying the same medium with ancient sort of ferns that were ecologically really prominent during the dinosaur ages. So before we had grasslands, we had fern prairies throughout much of the world. And the ferns that sort of took over these ecosystems are a group that I think are widely called tangle ferns, or they come from, or coral ferns. And they're really crazy because they have these indeterminate fronds that just keep on dichotomizing endlessly. And so these sorts of ferns are really common in some parts of the tropics today in mountain areas, but they're very difficult to grow. And so I wanted to sort of recreate these sort of dinosaur habitats for our collection. So I got these things germinated, and they took off in the same substrate as well. So I started seeing that, oh my gosh, all these ancient plants are really, they seem to have this commonality in what they like in terms of conditions. And part of that was coming into place and understanding why these sediments worked so well was I was working on these early land plants at the time, and you know, I started realizing, well, these plants evolved and diversified originally before soils were invented. They lived in these sort of, you know, nutrient depauperate, you know, extremely harsh, barren landscapes without forests. There weren't even such thing as meandering rivers when these plants were around.
Really?
They basically be like walking around near a glacier. So the rivers that were around at that time were basically these very I think they're like alluvial fans is what they call them. They're these rivers with tons of sandbars, but there's no really directional, you know, channelized currents. They're very spread out over the landscape. So there's a lot of erosion. There's not a lot of fast currents in the water. So these plants were probably living, you know, in all sorts of these, waterside environments, wet soils, you know, in unstable habitats. And they're very good at cloning themselves. So they would make these big clonal mats. And when rivers, you know, would flood, or, you know, the sandbar might get washed away, they'd break up and their rhizomes would, or their runners would run, you know, get basically lodged in the soil, much like some willows today do.
Mm. Wow, that is remarkable. I mean, the amount of stuff you just kind of outlined, you're getting all of these different pictures. You've got artistic expression, you've got your passion for kind of ancient, paleolithic or paleontological, discoveries. And then, you know, you've got the hobby for wanting to grow things, which is kind of teaching you a little bit more about the time period in which these plants arose. That's incredible. And, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. It sounds funny to say soils hadn't been invented yet, but you're talking about the earliest days of plants invading land. And when you think about what soil essentially is it's mineral breakdown and also detritus breakdown from living things, mostly plants. So if you're talking about the first days in which, you know, days being a broad sense plants coming onto land. Yeah, you're right. There wouldn't be soil because the plants really hadn't built up yet. And then, you know, to have rivers, you need transpiration a lot of times. To have a functioning water cycle, the plants really make that happen. So you're uniquely looking back in time in the fossil record, but also seeing these leftover remnants of an era that is so vastly different than what we know today.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're really... And the appearance, like when I was listening to Chad's interview with you, a lot of the things he said just ring absolutely true with these plants. I mean, they look so alien. They have these bizarre symmetries and ways of, you know, just developing. And they're very stereotypical in their morphology. I mean, a lot of them branch like tuning forks. They dichotomize. And the lycophytes in particular are well known for everything, shoots, roots, they dichotomize. And some of the early lycophytes that I was studying, so when we were doing this fossil work, we came across a new fossil. I mean, I would call it a new fossil species, and we called it that in our article that we wrote about it. But I mean, in reality, you know, species concepts are very different for, you know, a paleobotanist than, you know, a modern botanist. You know, we can only work with morphology, and that can be sometimes misleading. But we had these just trippy lycophytes in the past that almost all the lycophytes, except for I think two or three species of Sladgenella, have only one vein in their leaves. So they have what are called microphyllous leaves or lycophylls. But there was this lycophyte in the past called Leclerchia, and a number of these other relatives of it that had these just wild sort of needle-like leaves that had all these bifurcations in them. So they would, you know, it almost looked like an Artemisia, weird. But it's a lycophyte with Artemisia like crazy lacy leaves with hooked spines on the ends that it may have used to clamber up other plants, you know, a little bit like bling hooks on a bramble.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've been doing weird things and oddly stereotyped, but yeah, I'm very convinced that, you know, the more work that's being done in places with fantastic fossil, you know, potential and records, like in parts of China, more work that keeps on being done there, and the more freaky and weird the freak show gets with these things. Like we learn that there's all these bizarre ways of life these lycophytes, you know, done. They're like aliens. I mean, yeah. If you were to plant on Mars and give it, you know, light, nutrients and everything, you might get a lycophyte if you, you know, put an early plant on there.
That's they just cool.
Did everything differently.
Yeah. No, and that's it's great too to think about that, because yeah, I mean the more you find, the richer these ecosystems get. And, you know, it's easy to think that it was the early days, so not much was going on, but you know, the physics of life was there. Why wouldn't you see diversification? Now to do this, though, to piece these together, I mean, you have living examples, but they're, you know, a mere shadow of what they used to be. What's it like as a paleobotanist to try and not only reconstruct a potential species, but also the ecosystem? I mean, how do you get the resolution that you just described earlier? You know, where do you start, I guess? Where's the start?
I think the best place to start for this, I was sort of encountering and grappling with those situations a few years ago, actually, when I was trying to reconstruct this new species and do a sort of 3D illustration of it. And it really came down to, I mean, we really have to start at these places, these certain fossil assemblages called Lagerstätten, which are basically these just, you know, they're basically like a biodiversity hotspot in the fossil record. They're these exquisitely preserved assemblages of, say, plants and animals in many cases. One of them, for luckily the Devonian period, the time period that I was studying early in the evolution of plants, it has its own Lagerstätten assemblage that's really famous up in Scotland called the Rhynie Chert. And the Rhynie Chert is just a fantastic example, you know, of exquisite fossil preservation. I mean, we're talking, so this was a hot spring or a volcanic sort of area that had hot springs and geysers. And there were these sort of marshlands around the geysers, kind of like what you might see in parts of Yellowstone today. And as these geysers would erupt, they would flood these ecosystems with, you know, hot silica-rich waters. And the silica would basically crystallize when it would cool and would lock cellular-level, you know, details in the plants around that were growing around this area. So we have, you know, just incredible detail in these 400-million-year-old fossils that you can see, you know, cells, you know, I don't remember if you can actually see cells that are like halfway through division, but it's pretty close.
Wow. And
they've got like nematodes that are inside some of the cells. They've got nematodes mating, I think, too. And they've got mites inside sporangia of some of these things. Like, It's just like everything just was stuck in a freezer yesterday.
A dream for someone like yourself.
Oh my God, yeah. And they have soft tissue, you know. The first, I think the first genitalia of an animal are from the Rhine Chert. They found a little harvestman, like a little daddy long legs, and it actually has the entire reproductive system intact. No way. It looks spitting image of the modern ones. So yeah, it's crazy.
Jeez.
But yeah, so some of these plants, you know, the early lycophytes, we have a lot of the knowledge we have is because of places like the Rhine Chert, where we happen to get a snapshot of these early lycophytes. And, you know, you can, taking these chert rocks, you can cut them in any direction and get basically these cross sections that look like a modern histology section of a modern petunia or something. It's just everything's there. And they found mycorrhizal fungi inside the tissues of these plants.
No way.
Just crazy. Huh. Yeah. Wild stuff.
Jeez. But, And just to put this in perspective, you're working in Devonian time period. How old are these fossils?
So the fossils that I work with are probably around, I think they're about 375 million years ago.
Oh, man.
This was a few years ago. I was working on the Devonian, early Devonian or middle Devonian plants. I now work on mass extinctions, and in particular, Earth's largest mass extinction. And that's another peculiar event. So I've sort of been drawn to these times in Earth history that are just so alien from anything we know today, because I don't know, it just sort of makes me really excited. Yeah, during the Earth's biggest mass extinction, I found out not long after joining Dr. Stromberg's lab that during this time, forests disappeared all over the world. I mean, we don't really know why. There's just sort of, so this is about 250 million years ago, we just see just an enormous diversity of fossil life on Earth just disappear. And it's really been a long-standing mystery, because so much may have been going on and so much wrong may have been happening during this time. I mean, the world's largest volcanic province was forming up in Siberia at this time, and it was, you know, emitting enough lava to pave the entire United States several feet deep. And or at least cover the whole world in about 2 feet of lava or something like that.
Jeez.
It's just crazy. And I mean, it's an area like that spans much of Russia now. Like, this whole area had all these eruptive pipes, you know, exploding at different times over about a million year period. And a lot of ideas have come, you know, recently the rocks in this volcanic province have been dated, and these lava flows have been dated to be actually coincide very closely with times that animal disappearances happen in the fossil record. So, you know, there's a whole slew of ideas of what this volcano may have been doing and what havoc it may have been reaping on the environment. But what I found interesting was that as the forests disappear, lycophytes take over the world. And we get this weird, it seems like you push the rewind button on Earth's history, and you suddenly are back in the Devonian again, and you've got a lycophyte-dominated world where the trees just can't compete anymore, and somehow these weird pioneering lycophytes are just doing great. And we don't really see the same thing with ferns there. Like, during this extinction, we don't see a fern spike like we do after the asteroid impact 65 million years ago. So the lycophytes were probably doing something very differently than how we traditionally think of ferns, you know, being opportunists. So the lab I'm in now is with Dr. Cindy Loy at University of California, Berkeley. And we basically, as a research team there with her and Dr. Ivo Downstay there, we've been trying to figure out, you know, what makes these lycophytes tick? What allows them to get an upper hand under some possibly stressful situations? And it sort of ended up being a really symbiotic sort of research subject for me, because I was already working with these lycophytes and finding in the greenhouse that, you know, wow, they love stress. They seem to be, they're this odd paradox, because they're incredibly delicate. They're very sensitive, and they're very easy to kill. You know, if you just don't have enough water around, they're toast. They cannot recover from loss of turgor pressure. So, like, as soon as their shoots go limp, they're dead. Yeah, so they're not very forgiving. So that was really brutal learning that. I was going, what? Okay, I'll just water it, water it. Hope it comes back. It's like, nope, it just rots.
And it's gone.
It's gone. But yeah, but somehow they can deal with stress. And I, you know, we're still not sure exactly how, but I've been trying to work through my graduate, you know, studies, doing experiments with them under environmental stress, you know, to figure out what sort of environmental cues might give them an advantage over, you know, more competitive plants.
Wow. Those are incredible insights. So in thinking about this on a deeper perspective, do you think the fact that these lineages really kind of came on board during this time before, as you said, soil was invented, do you think that has something to do with the fact that you see them succeeding after things get really tough, like after these large major extinction events?
Yeah, I think that a big factor is, you know, has a lot of connection with why they might actually have this advantage is that, yeah, they evolved in a world that was, you know, completely alien from the age of seed plants. I mean, they function and are able to sort of go back into this, or they maintain this ecological sort of preference. And today they tend to be around because they can live in these sort of minimal environments. You know, you usually, if you really want to go, you know, lycophyte spotting, like a, you know, I guess a bird fancier would be, 60 mile an hour botany is the best way to do it on a highway in the mountains. Like, get high up somewhere in the mountains and look out, you know, onto clay soils, clay road embankments. And that's usually where these things will be doing really well, is because there'll have been a recent disturbance, but the roadside itself might stay intact for long enough for them to deal with these nasty sort of mineral soils. But the funny thing was, you know, it took me a while of going out in their habitats and collecting them to sort of put two and two together, looking at the soil going, oh, yeah, well, actually, they don't really want any of these things that we're saying we want to give them. They want this. And this stuff looks like it should kill everything I would put in a pot. Yeah, one of the things that's funny about them, though, is that people had reported, you know, about a century ago, anecdotally, that, oh yeah, well, I scooped up some of the soil in their habitats and they did okay. And one of the things that I learned over time was that soils behave very, very differently in the environment than they do in a pot. So if you collect the natural or native soil of a lot of plants and you stick it into a flat or a pot in a greenhouse, a lot of times the plant will still die, but it'll take a little while and usually it'll rot out, because most of these sediments that they've grown in the wild are so fine-grained that they don't have many air pockets. And in a pot where it's really confined, you just get water logging, whereas in the wild, the water can percolate and move through the sediment and bring air and oxygen with it. So it's sort of a, when you cultivate these things, you sort of have to mimic the environment, but you also have to sort of deviate or divert from that a little bit. So it's been sort of an interesting balancing act.
Now, when you talk about structures like roots, it's not like these evolved in lycophytes and then land plants just inherited them. This kind of was an independent evolutionary trajectory, was it not?
Their roots are as unique to them as they are to plants. So one of the things that's really amazing, or that captivated me about the lycophytes, is that almost absolutely everything you identify about a land plant that a lycophyte has, it evolved separately. Their roots, their leaves, they even developed a mechanism similar to seeds out of megaspores that's completely independent of all the other plants. So these giant coal swamp tree lycophytes, the ones that we call in the group Lepidodendrales, or these scale trees. Some of these things, I mean, they'd get well over 100 feet tall and they'd have 6 foot diameter plus trunks at the base, but they'd be 6 foot diameter at the top of the tree too. So there was almost no tapering. They're basically like telephone poles. And, you know, these things were crazy. They had these wild dichotomizing roots and these strange sort of, you know, subterranean branching structures called stigmaria. So they'd have, you know, these weird snaking branches that might go out 50 feet in every direction or more from the tree that weren't really roots. They'd anchor the plant in. And then on each one of these stigmarian axes, or these these underground shoots, they'd shoot out spirals of these highly dividing, dichotomizing roots. And it was only, I think, in the last 2-3 years that a grad student figured out that these roots that were on there actually branched and were very long. You know, they might get over a meter long each. So they were amazingly weird, complex plants. And the other thing that really is so bizarre about these things is that today we only have 3 different families remaining. We have a group called quillworts, Isoateles or Isoatacei. We have Selaginella, the Selaginellaceae or Selaginellales. And then we have the club mosses, which are called Lycopodiales and now represented by Lycopodiaceae as a family. And one of those groups, the quillworts, actually is the only, you know, living relative directly to these giant scale trees. And if you were to see them today, they grow at the bottoms of lakes, or, you know, they're oftentimes aquatic or subaquatic, and they look like little onions or something just totally, you know, benign. Nothing exotic here.
Yeah, I don't know if I could actually pick out a quillwort from something like a juncus submerged underwater when I'm just, you know, hiking around looking for other plants. They're weird.
Absolutely. And the weird thing about those plants is that they can switch their photosynthetic pathway facultatively. They can basically, you bring them out of water and they'll ditch all of their aquatic leaves and grow a totally new type of leaf and perform C3 photosynthesis on land, like most majority of land plants. But if you stick them underwater, they'll ditch their stomata and they'll form these stomataless leaves. And they'll breathe through their roots, and they'll use CAM photosynthesis underwater, like a desert plant. So, yeah, but they're really weird in that they can fix carbon from their roots. It's really strange. So they're breathing in CO2 through their roots, taking it in and doing everything in the leaves, but they have no stomata. So they're really a bizarre group. And there was a guy by the name of Keeley here in California who was working on one of these Isoetes and discovering these, you know, physiological anomalies in these plants. And I think there are other plants in the Isoetes habitat that actually have similar traits. So Lobelia dortmannii is another plant that grows oftentimes with Isoetes and looks very much like it. And I think it also practices aquatic CAM. So there's this weird sort of ecosystem that these plants live in that allow them and select for these strange traits. And one of the thoughts with Isoetes is that they're living oftentimes in mountain lakes or in these cold, what we call oligotrophic lakes, where there's very little nutrients. And they're basically not, they're also being CO2 starved. So they have to basically hack into the dirt to get their CO2. And we think that in some ways the giant scale trees actually may have had the same problem. They were living in a world with much, much lower atmospheric CO2 concentrations compared to most other times in Earth's history. It was what we call an ice house world, where we had glaciated poles like today and very low CO2 levels. And
yeah,
the oxygen was higher. I mean, you have these like dragonflies bigger than seagulls. I mean, it was a strange world. And these lycophytes had this competitive ability, or at least this stress tolerating ability, to dominate these swamp environments that just no other plant was able to replace after them. They form these very bizarre swamp-like forests. And they just seem to have been around, you know, for millions of years, these same ecosystems. And when one tree lycophyte would die out, another type of tree lycophyte would always come in, but no other lineage of plant would replace it. So these things really, we don't know a lot of their secrets, and there's a lot of work to do yet on figuring out what makes the modern ones tick to get an idea of what these fossil ones do.
Dang. I mean, that you just blew my mind so much, because, you know, you think you know paleobotany and then you hear stuff like that and you're like, I get why alien is the best word you can use, because there's really no modern analog to this kind of community. And geez, no. Wow. That's pretty remarkable. I mean, are there estimates on how diverse this lineage was at one point, you know, compared to now?
I mean, there certainly are. I haven't been too up to date on sort of the diversity curves for the lycophytes in the past. But being a paleobotanist, I've sort of gotten this sort of weird chip on my shoulder where, like, I just don't trust anything now because everything was so weird and crazy in the past. And every time you hear a new paper in China describing a new crazy outlandish Leica fight, it just hits you like out of nowhere or out of left field. I would have a hard time trying to make an estimate, you know, a guess of how diverse they were in the past. Yeah. But what I can say is based on what we know in the fossil record, just morphologically, I mean, it was just off the charts compared to anything they have today. And that's quite an accomplishment because the modern Leica fights are greatly underappreciated and they display a lot of diversity in ecology, function, and form. And they oftentimes, I mean, they represent a very, very tiny portion of the world's flora. I mean, I don't know if it's like less than 1 or 3% of the described vascular plant species today. But a lot of times when you're out seeing them, they're doing pretty well in a lot of their environments. Selaginella, for instance, is one that's, it blew my mind to take a fern course in Costa Rica and that, oh my God, Selaginella is a dominant in these canopy understories, like in the tropical rainforest of all places.
Yeah.
And it's probably for the same reason too. I mean, you're dealing with nutrient stress. Everything's breaking down, decaying, and getting taken up so quickly that, you know, these depauperate mineral soils below these trees just are perfect for some lycophytes. So
yeah,
they're great.
It's so cool. And again, the appreciation you must have, you know, having this deep time perspective must make trips like that all the better. You know, anyone that ever says science kind of ruins poetry or the beauty of the world, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't talk to people such as yourself, because the wonder you can just hear coming off of it, it's so cool. And the fact that, you know, like you said, they're a mere shadow of what they once were, but even today there's this diversity of forms. I mean, there's even epiphytic lycophytes, right? Like ones that specialize on growing in the canopy on a tree.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's even a lineage, you know, that's being worked on now by a number of, you know, people. So that one's, so those are huperzioids. And my colleagues Ashley Field and Wes Testo have been doing fantastic sort of new phylogenetic sort of trees of these things. And they're learning amazing things about the diversification of these plants. And, you know, that's a lineage or a clade that we think is, you know, it's been around a long time. I mean, and it has. It diverged long, long ago, well before the Jurassic probably, from the other lycophytes. And its diversification has just been rapid. And it sort of is a great case study along with, you know, a number of other plants like cycads, I mean, for instance, where the whole notion of the living fossil has just been turned on its head. I mean, I sort of just tell students now, well, when they ask me about living fossils and what's a living fossil and what's not, I'm like, there isn't such thing as a living fossil. Fossils are dead. They're gone. They're extinct. What's alive today is very different and has been changing and mutating and undergoing all sorts of natural selection, you know, every step of the way with all our flowering plants. So they're quite modern for their lineages in many ways, but they do on the genetic basis. Yeah, they're quite modern. The species are new entities, but functionally, many of them may actually be conserving or maintaining these sorts of ancient ways of life. And that's sort of what I think gets a lot of horticulturalists like myself and Chad and such, you know, going, is that, wow, these things have really been able to hack it this long, keep up with the pace of all this competition, and they're still doing, you know, functioning in pretty similar way. You know, if it ain't broke, you know, why fix it?
Right, right. No, and that's a hard thing to kind of get through to people that don't spend a lot of time thinking about evolution, is it's not this constant upgrade. It's not that, oh, the new one's out, we got to get better. Sometimes if it works, just do it. And if you can continue kind of eking out an existence in that, you know, hypothetical niche space, what need do you have to change drastically?
Yeah, there isn't really much of one. And when these mass extinctions come along, that's sort of when that's the game changer in many cases. Right. You start really seeing, okay, maybe it was actually really useful to keep those traits going for all these millions of years, because now we really need them. Because, yeah, I mean, you really, at least at this end Permian extinction that we study, man, it's just such a strange phenomenon to see that these sort of underdogs are doing so well. It's like if you woke up to a world of nothing but daffodils. You know, you go to Antarctica, daffodils, you know, no ice, mind you, on the poles. Forests of daffodils on the poles. And you go to the Amazon, you know, area or the equatorial latitudes, just daffodils. And It's like that for 5 million years in some places. Jeez. It's like, what on earth? Maybe one or two genera of lycophyte.
Really?
Like, it's really down to, like, some of these Iso-Italian, these Isoides relatives just come back in force.
And then achieve global dominance.
Yeah. And, I mean, they're not the only things around. There's certainly, you know, other plants and other, you know, gymnosperms. The gymnosperms made it through this extinction, but they suffered major casualties. And the one of the big reasons I've really been interested in this extinction is that it's the only one where really the plants take a massive hit. You know, most of the time that we have mass extinctions, they're defined by the disappearance of animals. Mm. And in most of the cases, you know, plants don't really get much of a mention in, you know, fossil studies. You know, they'll be talking about, well, the dinosaurs did this, the mammals did this, the reptiles did this. But, you know, we're now getting, you know, a whole, you know, new generations of paleobotanists who have really been going in and, you know, asking questions about what happens to the vegetation in an ecological sense. And, you know, I know that students working with Dr. Caroline Stromberg are working on these questions. And there's a nice legacy of paleobotanists that have worked, you know, on after the asteroid impact. Both now there's some really crazy work coming out of Patagonia with Dr. Peter Wilf's lab, where they're finding that, you know, the vegetation in Patagonia may have been experiencing refugia-like symptoms, or at least a lot of these plants may have actually been okay, where the asteroid where it hit and how it hit may have impacted North America's flora very harshly and disproportionately. So we see that these extinction events can be very heterogeneous across the landscape. And it really, you know, it's a lesson we always should think about when we think about the fossil record, is that the world is always quite variable, and, you know, there's no formula for what takes over one place is going to do well in another. And, you know, we only have so many places to see the rock record so well. So we're only getting snapshots and trying to piece together these global patterns, but it's fraught with, we know we're very appreciative that we may not have the right answer. And that's actually been something I've really taken comfort in. I know I'm probably not right on a lot of things, but I'm comfortable with it. And I'm comfortable with someone else coming in and going, oh, you know, this actually was totally different. And that's sort of the wonder of it. It's sort of like science in general, but in a nice way that, you know, you only have so much you can work with. Might as well make the best estimate that you can.
Right. And no one's losing in that scenario. You're all gaining because the knowledge is like, it's another step forward.
Yeah. And we call it sometimes paleo fantasy in our current lab.
That's fun. Ah, man, you have such a cool perspective on the world, and you get to do so many awesome things, both in the fossil record and with extant plant species. I think a lot of people look upon you with envious eyes, but in the best way possible. You got to keep it up.
I'm trying. I'm now shifting more toward the modern plants these days because, these lycophytes, I mean, they're disappearing across the world, and there's very few people who grow them or who have managed to grow them so far. And so my sort of new, I guess I'd call it like a crusade, is that, okay, every time I figure out how to grow one of these things, I need to publish a scientific paper describing the methods in, you know, just absolute detail. So I have these sort of just, the papers I've been writing are just painful to read. I have a hard time just reading them when I'm reviewing them. Like, oh, this is so boring. But every little detail is in there. And Chad Husby, of all people, really had encouraged me when I decided to sort of go, well, maybe I should just, you know, publish this thing or describe what worked for me back in undergrad. And Chad was like, yes, do it. Like, you know, just because there aren't that many papers out right now describing that, you know, doesn't mean they shouldn't be.
That's vitally important information.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just kind of got hooked. And now I'm like, well, of all the, you know, I've been working on paleobotany subjects, and I find that to be, it's a passion of mine. And the growing these plants and learning what makes them tick and, you know, trying to figure out ways to conserve them has also been really a passion. But I've been finding that, you know, I get a lot more people interested in figuring out, okay, well, how do we grow the modern ones these days? And so, you know, we're in the midst of, it's the sixth mass extinction now. And I mean, it's very scary to think that, you know, a lot of these plants that I've appreciated for so long they might not be here for, you know, future generations if, you know, we don't act quickly to try and,
right,
you know, get them established. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, that's sort of now where I'm hoping to head toward, is really just diving headfirst into horticultural and conservation sort of issues to try and save these ancient plants, or at least help our community have the tools to be able to do that.
That's excellent, man. I mean, it's tragic to think that, you know, lineages that have made it through 300, almost 400 million years now face us and are struggling, you know. So, you know, for anyone listening that kind of gets disheartened by this sort of thing, I mean, what are the major threats and what can the average listener do to make sure that, you know, lycophytes will be around for future?
Sure. I think the biggest threat is habitat alteration and, you know, the loss of habitats. I mean, our rainforests are disappearing, of course, you know, at an astronomically fast rate. And we also don't always protect or think about protecting, you know, even roadsides or places that have been, you know, altered by humans, that maybe some of these ancient plants and even, you know, terrestrial orchids and things might even, you know, how find their way to. And, you know, so habitats, the world's changing and we need to change with it, but we also need to understand how, you know, these plants are eking new niches and finding ways to make it. And what I think people can do is, you know, work with what you can. And I think for growing plants, really just trying to grow whatever you can. If there's something that you see, you know, I tell people, and I think it's a common issue where, you know, if some lands are going to be developed, find and talk to maybe the construction, you know, firm that's working on it and go, hey, can I come in and like try and rescue some plants? Then you give those plants a second chance. And there's some nurseries that actually specialize in doing that. They they go out, even in the tropics too, places where there's, you know, logging, there's some companies in Ecuador that, you know, will harvest orchids and lycophytes and ferns and all these plants, you know, just do a full census where, you know, they know the bulldozers are going to come, you know, and then they distribute those. But, you know, the propagation is really the force that keeps this going. As long as you keep cloning, they can't go extinct. Now, that said, it really, some facilities and some places that you're growing things, it might not work as well. But I would say, you know, don't ever be too scared to try to grow something. Don't be afraid to try something new if maybe your first soil didn't work. Or for me, if I didn't check back and actually see the success I did, I may have given up too early. So it takes
And my, how different your trajectory would have been. You know, those are all great points, and I'm really happy to hear them, because all, you know, some of my favorite botanizing sites are roadsides. I'd rather the road not be there sometimes, but at the same time, to look upon that and go, you are unclean and unfit for our attention, that's robbing important, you know, species of their value.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. Well, I really appreciate everything you've just outlined. I think that you've just given a lot of people a lot of food for thought and some deep necessary perspective, but your work's an inspiration, man. I can't tell you that enough. If people want to find out more about it, you know, you've hinted that you've got some big publications along the way. You know, how do they keep track of your career and find out what's going on in the world of Jeff?
Well, I'm currently on Facebook, so I'm there. But I just started a Twitter account too, and I'm pretty new to all of that, so I'll be probably consulting with Chad to figure out, you know, how he's, you know, been able to market some of the plants. And so I'll hope to be posting on there too, with, you know, pictures of things I'm growing as well, and sharing plant knowledge that way.
Awesome.
So yeah.
Cool.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, no, thank you, dude. Again, very enlightening, and, you know, I look forward to everything that's going to come out of your work.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, keep in touch.
All right. We'll do.
Cheers.
All right. Cheers.
Seriously, how cool is that? I love that conversation, because it was a really well-resolved window back into a time very different from today. And again, it's all kind of centered around growing these plants and trying to figure out what they need in cultivation. That's so cool. And most of all, he's doing these big things, but he's a nice dude, and he just likes to grow plants. And I don't know about you, but those are my favorite kinds of people. I thank Jeff for taking time out of his busy schedule to talk with us. I'm sure that in the not-too-distant future, there's going to be a lot more publications with his name on it that are worth talking about. So this will not be his only time on the In Defense of Plants podcast. I have a feeling about that. All right, again, Appalachia is out. Head on over to youtube.com/indefensiveplants and give it a watch. It's fun. It's just a mere fraction of the botanical riches of the Southern Appalachian Mountains, but I think we put together a fun little documentary series for you, and there's plenty of other videos at the same time. So youtube.com/indefensiveplants. I've got a lot of cool episodes coming up, some really exciting scientific discussions on the horizon, and a few big announcements as well. But in the meantime, just make sure you hit subscribe, and somewhere mixed into that future episode jumble there is going to be the question show. I promised you guys I'd do one. Y'all submitted some incredible questions, and I just got to find the time to sit down and record it. All right, keep checking back, but otherwise, I hope you all have a great week. This is Matt signing out. Adios, everyone.